Good afternoon and welcome to the sixth briefing for municipal chief executive officers being conducted by the Baker Pulido administration. Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido is completing the daily briefing with Governor Baker for the citizens of Massachusetts, and she will be joining this briefing in just a few minutes. We are fortunate to have a number of key agency officials with us, and we will be able to start the briefing and then proceed, and then Lieutenant Governor will join us, and I'm sure we'll make specific remarks regarding today's announcement by the Governor and Lieutenant Governor that the stay-at-home advisory and the closure of non-essential workplaces will continue until May 18th, and a plan is being put in place with a top-level advisory committee on developing the protocols, procedures, guidelines, and recommendations for a phased reentry into commercial and business activity and more interaction in society. My name is Jeff Beckwith. I'm the executive director of the Massachusetts Municipal Association, and we are privileged to provide the platform for the administration's briefing. The first item of business for us today, we're very pleased to report that Commissioner Jeff Riley, the commissioner of DESE, is with us today to provide a brief overview of the resources that the Commonwealth is making available to local school districts in cities and towns and regional schools all throughout Massachusetts, and to talk a bit about what the school year will look like as it continues in earnest in different formats across Massachusetts. So Commissioner Riley, we thank you for joining this briefing and give you the floor.
Sure, thank you very much. Thanks for having us. Just kind of an overview of how we think about the pandemic and its effects on education. We've broken it into kind of what I consider to be four phases. The first phase being the first week when the governor closed schools. You know, we really focused on the health and safety of our students and staff. We made that our top priority. We then set up with local districts over 1,300 feeding sites. We followed that up with guidance around offering enriching activities for students during that week. We partnered with people like GBH to provide educational programming for students that didn't have connections to online learning. And we offered guidance that encouraged districts to continue paying hourly staff, special education schools, and school bus drivers. That was phase one. Phase two happened in week two, where we released our remote learning guidance, which basically said we expected kids to engage in meaningful and productive learning. We wanted staff to make multiple connections with students during the week, and we wanted staff to provide feedback to kids. That guidance was endorsed by the School Committee Association, the Superintendents Association, the PTA, the Charter School Association, and both teachers' unions. At the same time, we applied for waivers, both at the federal and state level around nutrition, finance, educator licensure, Student Opportunity Act, regional school districts, MCAS testing, and the competency determination. Phase three happened last week when the governor announced that we would be closing school for the year. We put out guidance shortly thereafter, which asked districts to go further than they've been going on teaching standards that we think are most crucial to what kids need to know in order to be able to progress to the school year. Remember, we usually spend the whole month of May testing, so now we have the whole month of May and June to teach, and we think it's a great opportunity for us to really double down and focus on the most essential standards that kids need to know so they can be ready for the next grade level. At that same time, we have put, or in the process, I should say, of putting our CARES application into the federal government, which should be about $214 million if it's approved, and we have more information on that. The fourth and last phase might be the most crucial phase, and something that I think is probably most germane to what we're talking for you guys, which is this idea of preparing for school reentry. We're working with health experts to try to figure out what a reentry plan could look like. We have seen other countries bring their schools back online, but it has not been kind of writ large. It's been with special safety measures that have been put in place. this isn't an exhaustive list of things, but this is what just some of the kind of things that schools are doing in other countries include checking students' temperatures when they come into school randomly, kids wearing face masks in school, staggering schedules so that only half a school shows up at any one time and the other half of school is out doing remote learning, keeping desks 6 feet apart, and in some cases having kids stay in one classroom and moving the teachers instead of the kids. And so some of these things have financial costs and applications, particularly when we start talking about masks or the purchasing of thermometers and things like that. So in order to be ready, we are hoping that we'll have the summer, at least some summer program, to be able to have kind of a soft opening to try some of these things out, and that we won't only get the first chance to start in the fall. But that is, you know, to be determined by the administration. I'm going to turn it over to Bill Bell, my CFO, to kind of offer you kind of a financial perspective really quickly. But I know there's been some interest around the guidance I put out about encouraging districts to pay hourly staff, special education schools, and buses. And I recognize the tension that develops here. For me, I felt like I had an obligation to protect my educational community, particularly when, you know, the money for hourly staff has been budgeted. We need those paraprofessionals and other folks to try to assist teachers in the learning process. We need them to get trained up in case, as is typically the case, we need more teachers than we actually have in the fall. When we talk about special education schools, we wanted people to keep paying their special education schools because in the fall, we were worried that some of those schools might go under and out of business, and then we'd have nowhere to send our most complex children. And then with school buses, we know there's some people that have kind of renegotiated the contracts. Some people have had them do work around delivering meals, and there's a different process. But my recommendation was to try as much as possible to keep those folks, because my fear is, and I'll just give you one example, I know there's a town that decided to drop its busing budget and lay off its bus drivers. And when they did that, a lot of the bus drivers collected unemployment, and some of them, a good number of them, may have gone back to their country of origin, which is outside of the continental United States. And I just worry that in the fall, we may not be able to get these bus drivers back, so that districts that wound up cutting some of their services might find it hard to start back up in the fall and thus creating a bigger problem. But with that said, I'm going to turn it over to Bill Bell, who's going to talk to you about kind of the process for FY20 and how we're doing with grants and such.
Good afternoon, everyone. Just a couple of quick punctuations of what the commissioner said. As it relates to current budget year resources, all of our funding that is in one shape or another a payment to a municipality, school district, is available. That includes all of our state aid as well as reimbursement accounts, as well as all state grants and federal grants in which we are the pass-through entity. So nothing has changed in terms of being able to access funding to the extent you get eligible cost. You know, consistent with the programs that particularly your school officials are all intimately aware of. We take our guidance from the executive office and the administration as the with respect to if there are going to be any changes. We're not aware of any changes coming with respect to FY20 spending. So we continue to have access to, and you as municipalities and school departments have access to all the funding. The commissioner did mention quickly the Federal CARES Act or the Plan 3 or coming out of the federal government. In that $2.2 trillion federal legislation, there is one grant opportunity directed solely at K-12 or specifically for K-12. It's the Elementary and Secondary Ed Emergency Education Support. It's a fund that we are applying for in the next week or so. There's an application process we need to go through. The funding will be made available. 90% of the funding will be made available, consistent with the law, directly to municipalities, the way we calculate the Title I federal grant. And I know I'm speaking in some code, but Title I is the main federal education reimbursement for districts with concentrations of low income and at need students. 10% is to be reserved for the department, for the commissioner, not for administrative costs, but to actually find gaps and where additional services are needed. So we'll be working in conjunction with the secretary and the governor with respect to that 10% as well. There is additional funding in the act. It comes directly to the governor. Secretary Pizer and his team are leading that application. That's worth $50.8 million. Those funds are designed to cover the needs of higher education, K-12, as well as early ed. BOE has point on that. I'm also aware, but I can't speak to, and you folks probably know it better, and the administration in the form of ANF and the Lieutenant Governor and Deputy Commissioner Cronin may be able to speak to that, is I don't know where the other funding that's coming out of the act as it relates to municipal aid and municipal relief related to COVID-19. So as it relates to DESE-specific funding, all existing appropriations, both state and federal, are available. And we are in the process of making application and receiving an additional $215 million in grant funding. I'll stop there.
Well, thank you very much. I think there are a lot more details about accessing and use of those funds, and we look forward to more information coming from the department. Commissioner, we appreciate having you with us and your team. I do notice that Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido has joined the call. And if we can just do a quick double check to see, because there's such a big announcement coming today, whether the Lieutenant Governor is available to begin her briefing, then we can move to that section. So Lieutenant Governor, are you available?
I am here. So thank you for a little bit of time with all of you this afternoon. Again, on behalf of the governor and our team, we so appreciate everything that you're doing to get us to this point, from a, you know, a health and safety response to COVID-19. Today, we just had our press avail at noon, and we were able to make further decisions known regarding the stay-at-home advisory and the assignment of a advisory board for the development of a plan for reopening, a phased-in opening of our economy, which is all really good to be thinking about and planning for, just being mindful of where we are from a public health standpoint, knowing that we still have 3,900 people hospitalized. We reported over 1,500 new cases yesterday. So it's really just important that we continue to look at the data, which we have a lot of, including those hospitalizations throughout the health networks across our Commonwealth. I would say it that we are flat. We've been like in this flat plateau for about 13 days. What we'd like to see is a decline in those numbers, a decline, especially in those hospitalizations, that will inform us about the conditions making a safe reopening in a phased manner possible. So until then, we took action today on the stay-at-home advisory and extended that until May 18th. We've also tasked, it will be Secretary Keneally and I leading an advisory board that will convene actually right after this call for the first time. And the advisory board has 17 members. There are 11 industry members, all from parts across our Commonwealth. There are three municipal members and three public health members. The municipal members are Mayor Dan Rivera Lawrence, Mayor of East Hampton, Nicole LaChapelle, and City of Boston Mayor's Office is also part of this. I'd like to acknowledge that there are 11 business leaders, CEO types, owners, business owners that will also advise us. And I see this as a parallel track between the interactions that we are going to have with industry leaders, reacting to and sharing with us information around what a safe workplace looks like for employees and customers. And we will provide them with some, I'd say, describe it as a checklist of items. You know, what does safe distancing look like in your workplace? What does sanitization look like? Hand washing stations, and the list like that, separators, you know, plastic barriers between areas where a worker might come in closer contact with another, but maybe that barrier could be helpful in a manufacturing place. And have industry leaders respond to us around what their safety plan looks like, what they've incorporated, and what they feel from a capacity standpoint they can start with in a reopened part of the economy. We're also asking municipal leaders, and while we have three on the advisory board, and we'd love to have all of you, what we've asked for is MMA, and I believe with Jeff's leadership, he's formed a work group within MMA, and we've asked the Metro Mayors and MAPC to also set up a very small team to be able to meet with us and analyze with us the things that we're hearing. Because ultimately, you folks are the ones that need to know that your community is safer for these reopenings and gatherings, and can be the enforcers as well if things don't add up and they need to. So we will have you right there with us as we always do to help make smart decisions for a safer Commonwealth in the phase of reopening after this virus and the medical, you know, public health metrics advise us to be able to do so. So that was a very good news today, I feel. And as I stated, we're going to meet this afternoon, but then, you know, just for the next 2 weeks, meeting regularly through the Zoom technology, and also taking input from those that may not want to present through a Zoom meeting, but give us some information to chew on, and we will. The idea is for this group to have a deliverable. So on around May 18th, deliver a product, which will be a plan for phasing in reopening of certain activities and workplaces throughout our Commonwealth. And so we're extending the orders beyond May 4th to May 18th to allow for this analysis, receive input, and then make some decisions with you going forward. So I can stop there, or I can continue to talk about some of these other things, but I might like to just listen to you just quickly on nursing homes. We made another announcement this week, adding another $130 million in funds in addition to the $130 allotted for the nursing home response. That has obviously become, it is a hot spot. 56% of Massachusetts' total COVID-19 deaths are from nursing homes and rest homes. So the $130 million will be used for a whole clinical response, crisis management, deployment of more National Guard, testing, infection control, PPE, staff, all of the things that we want to just ramp up to help these individuals and, of course, their families in these nursing facilities throughout our Commonwealth. The other is just an acknowledgement of our hospital capacity. While we have 3,900 in hospitalizations due to COVID-19, that means that we have a lot of capacity, bed capacity within our healthcare institutions, our hospitals. So those beds were taken offline for elective procedures because we wanted to have the ability to respond to a surge if that occurred within any region of our Commonwealth. But what's happening is there are many in our community that might need emergency care or need a procedure and are afraid to call or afraid to go to a hospital. We need to get the message out that if you are sick or you don't feel well, you can talk to your doctor, but there is capacity to handle these situations so that they don't escalate into something more severe for people in our community. Community health centers have been terrific. We're partnering up with them more so in Quest Diagnostics to do a lot of more testing in places like Quincy, Brockton, Lowell, Fall River, New Bedford, Worcester, Provincetown, multiple sites in Boston, and we will expand the testing capacity, which will be an integral part of the future, in order to make sure that we're testing in places to see if we're containing or if there is spread and being able to respond to that. Last week, we talked about the Food Security Task Force to examine the supply chain, not only now to respond to needs within our community, but as individuals remain out of work and have economic hardship, access to food and having a supply chain that works for them is really important. So I'll leave it at that. Just want to thank you, and I really look forward to working with all of you on this reopening plan for our Commonwealth.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor. I think that it makes sense to take a look in our chat function, is where people are asking questions. There are a couple of questions that came up just regarding the announcement and the vision for reopening Massachusetts. And I think it would make sense to sort of take those questions at this time and then go to the more general discussion of municipal specific issues. And I think that you touched on those during your briefing with the governor just a few moments ago. The first is, when the time comes to reopen society, will the Commonwealth be looking at opening and phasing these rules in this process in statewide, or would you be looking at a regional approach?
That's a very good question, because there are regions of our Commonwealth that have low COVID positive outcomes, and we're mindful of that, while places in and around Boston have higher. So that is one of the considerations to determine how a safe reopening looks all across our Commonwealth. That's why we have industry leaders, municipal leaders, and need you to be able to talk with us about what that looks like in your community. It may not be a one size fits all for all aspects of our economy. There are certain principles of reopening that the public health team from the COVID Command Center has said to us that need to be in place as the trigger from a public health metric standpoint to even begin to reopen. So that needs to be in place. And then there are certain checklists, for lack of a better word, of items that we would need to ask industry leaders about to see if they're incorporating those features and best practices into their own reopening strategies. And once we feel comfortable and confident with you that these measures can be implemented, then we will phase this in. So I would say there might be industries that are not ready around that May 18th time to open, and there may be some that are ready. There might be industry sectors that feel certain parts of their industry are able to open, but other parts of it not. So those are all the things that we're taking into consideration, including the regional, you know, literally facts on the ground that will help guide our decision making.
And a related question, thank you very much on that. A related question has come up just regarding whether you're anticipating increasing the testing capacity as we move forward. There continue at these briefings to be lots of questions regarding testing for asymptomatic people, as well as increasing capacity for testing. We do know that Massachusetts, of the large states, has the second highest per capita testing amount and has really ramped up testing. But you envision even more testing as a part of your strategy. And then perhaps Dr. Madoff could answer the question about testing of asymptomatic people.
Yes, testing is important. As you all know, Massachusetts is a leader in testing, is a leader in the Partners in Health contact tracing effort, which is really important to continue to expand. And we will, because that allows us to determine if there are literally hot spots in places in the Commonwealth and how to address those in a, you know, in a specific way. So testing is an important part of it. And the science continues to evolve around testing success. You know, some testing programs are out there that have a lot of false positives and they're not 100% reliable. You've heard us talk about modeling. Models change and they have changed and evolved during this process. And we continue to impress upon the feds that they've included more money toward making more testing available. That's really important. And we look forward to seeing our capacity for testing expand. It would be, I would describe, as one of the tools in the toolkit. It's not the only feature that will allow us to create a safer Commonwealth. There are multiple tools in that toolkit. Testing is one of them. The social distancing, the wearing of face coverings, the capacity levels at certain activities and workplaces, all the sanitization, separations, and distancing and disinfecting within workplaces. All of that, there's a whole kit of these kinds of tools and assets that we'll need to maybe require, regulate, and certainly include in a reopening plan.
Thank you. And then just for clarity purposes, or maybe the clarity is impossible, for Dr. Madoff, just because we keep on getting this question, and this is the sixth briefing, we keep on getting the question about testing of asymptomatic people and whether that's a part of the strategy going forward. Is Dr. Madoff there? I don't think...
There I am, sorry. Thanks, Jeff, and thank you very much to the Lieutenant Governor who framed the public health issues very nicely. And the Public Health Department has, of course, been working very closely with the Command Center and the Governor and Lieutenant Governor on the guidelines for reopening and on the strategies. And as the Lieutenant Governor said, testing is one of the tools available. It has expanded dramatically in availability in the state. And at this point, the constraints are not so much around the testing itself, but around our ability to get it and material and personal protective equipment that's required to do the testing. But as Lieutenant Governor said, we're really leading the country in testing availability and the rates of testing of our residents. And we expect that to continue to expand more and expect more testing to become available. The PCR testing looking for the virus is our first line. And because there are still constraints on it, we want to prioritize that testing for symptomatic people who need to find out whether they have the illness. And asymptomatic testing in certain settings, for example, congregate settings, nursing homes, homeless shelters, other places where the guidance of testing asymptomatics can help us cohort, put together people who have the illness either symptomatically or asymptomatically so that they're not going to spread it to other members of the community. And then what I would say is that testing for the individual should be done with your healthcare provider. It's a discussion that any individual can have with their doctor if they're having symptoms, if they're in a situation where it's important for them to know if they could be asymptomatically infected. For example, if they live with someone who's vulnerable or have had a recent exposure, those would be settings where it might make more sense for an asymptomatic individual to be tested, and always with the warning that every test needs to be interpreted, and the interpretation of both a positive test and a negative test should be done with the healthcare provider. And a negative test is just a snapshot in time that someone who is negative today could become positive 3 hours later or tomorrow if they've been exposed. And so we don't want people to be sort of falsely reassured by that. The other area of testing that people are having questions about more and more frequently is around serology or antibody testing. And that's becoming increasingly available. And the knowledge about those tests is also increasing, but we're not yet at the point where it can be well interpreted for an individual. And we want to caution people against thinking that an antibody test, a positive antibody test, means that they're protected from infection, because we just don't know that yet. And it's really important that the science continue to go forward and we learn more about it. Those kinds of tests, the serology tests, are going to be very important on a population level for our epidemiologists to be able to understand how the disease is progressing in the state and what level of people have already been exposed. But on an individual basis, those tests are less useful at this point. So I'll stop there, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you. And we've had a couple of questions. This will be the final one on testing. I'll merge a couple. Just some confusion about how the testing is available to communities. There was an announcement by a community recently that all of its residents could get tested at area healthcare institutions. And there are some questions coming in saying, can the state allocate test kits directly to cities and towns similar to that community? Although I'm not sure that's the actual arrangement that that's in place, but there are obviously communities that are interested in making sure that their regions there's equity in terms of access to testing all throughout Massachusetts and not just in some areas, and that the testing be available in particular to communities where there's a concern about hotspots. Do you have any comments or thoughts about that?
Yeah, so it there are many different variations on how testing is made available, and in general, it's being made available by healthcare institutions or by medical practices, even community health centers, and at that level. And what I would encourage is for communities to work with the providers and the healthcare institutions in their area and with their local boards of health to figure out what kinds of testing make most sense for a particular location. It's not a one-size-fits-all situation, and I think that's why you're seeing different responses in different communities. Of course, we're available at the Department of Public Health to talk with local boards of health or other officials for specific questions.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. The availability of DPH is, there are so many different angles and questions that come up. And thank you for sharing that information and perspectives, Doctor. We now turn, I think, to the more municipal and finance aspect of the questions, which means perhaps Sean Cronin or maybe Elizabeth Denniston and others would jump in with the Lieutenant Governor on some of these questions that are here. The first question would be, are there any updates that you have regarding the state budget process? We understand it's only been a week since the last time we had a briefing, is there any other guidance or milestones or discussions that you've had collectively at the state regarding when more information might be available regarding the outlook for fiscal year 2021? And that's just the high level question. Then there are some specific questions that would follow. Let's see, Sean, want me to unmute you? Oh, there you are.
Yeah, there's no updates on my end for either 20 or 21 at this point.
Just in terms of the questions, and we know that the Commissioner of Education had to get off at 1:30, had another appointment. We appreciate him joining. There's obviously concern about fiscal year 2020, so it was good to hear both in terms of your previous updates and also the Department of Education and DESE talking about the no plans or no changes at this point in fiscal 2020 funds in terms of availability for school districts. I will say that from the MMA's perspective, there is concern regarding any effort that would require communities to pay for services that aren't being delivered, as opposed to making sure that they retain the option to renegotiate or alter their contracts for to allow for the to ensure the future delivery of services, but communities are experiencing revenue losses in fiscal year 2020 and will be struggling to balance their budgets, so they need flexibility on that end. A question, and if you can't answer it, perhaps it's just for the administration, obviously, to consider. The question is if there are decreases in Chapter 70 in the state budget, would you also look to give communities relief in terms of out-of-district vocational tuition or special education tuition or charter school assessments and so on? I'm not sure you can answer those questions, but they're important questions as the budget is being developed. And then also if state aid is being reduced, obviously relief on state assessments would be very helpful. Do you have any information or comments or acknowledgement of that?
I can say that that's something that's come up in previous discussions with local officials, finance officials, and it's certainly something that's on the ever-growing list.
And we do expect that as more information becomes available, it is April. Usually at this time, the House would have finished its budget deliberations, and we'd be anticipating what the Senate might be doing. And now, of course, we're in a year when the fundamentals are really called into question. So as much information as possible, as soon as possible, is what our members are asking for, obviously. And we know that you've been saying that you will provide that. There are questions regarding the logistics of municipal operations, in particular for town meetings. We know there is legislation, we hope, that will be considered soon regarding the conduct of town meetings, either allowing representative town meetings to meet remotely or to reduce the quorums for open town meetings so that town meetings can happen and people can be safely distanced and take care of the nuts and bolts. We know, again, you might want to revoice your support, the administration's support for these, but any updates on in terms of those efforts? There are several questions on those.
So as you know, this is Elizabeth Denniston. As you know, we filed something to give relief for town quorum requirements. And I think we are hopeful that the legislature is actively considering those. And we hope to see something soon.
Thank you very much. We thank you for filing the legislation. And it would be such a much more efficient process, obviously, for the state to make this change. As opposed to, it was one town, at least one community that was able to go to court and reduce their quorum requirement. But that's an extreme. It's a very difficult process, especially now with having to do everything virtually, everything remotely and virtually. There's a question that's come in regarding part of the CARES Act funds, and this has to do with the Community Development Block Grant funds that were included in the CARES Act. There are 37 communities in Massachusetts that are so-called entitlement communities. And that means that the vast majority of communities, about 89.5%, are not entitlement and therefore depend on the state for a distribution of those funds. And there's $20 million has been made available to the state. Is there any update on what, how those funds could be used for business and economic assistance, and whether or not, and when some guidance might come out about how that those funds might flow to the other communities in Massachusetts?
Yeah, I asked the Tim McGurthy at ATD about this yesterday. I have heard from a number of you regarding these CDBG funds. Some of you have said if you had those funds, you might be able to further assist your small businesses, for instance, in your downtown or Main Street area to help them with cash flow issues so that they make it to the other side of this. According to Tim's note back to me, they have not received these funds from HUD because they still haven't received the contract or the funding from HUD. We're looking at a program to set up, but we need the guidance and the funds from HUD, and we don't know yet what that timing is, but we'll continue to monitor it. I know that these are needed funds in your community.
Thank you very much. And we know that because you and Secretary Keneally will be working on the advisory board, that there'll be plenty of opportunities for us to remind the secretary to get that information out as quickly as possible. But we do know that this is a priority of yours, just because it's important to put these federal resources as they become available to use immediately, and communities across the state can do so. So thank you very much for that, and for the administration's diligence in that regard. Here's a question regarding furloughs, and this is obviously a very challenging and sensitive subject, but if with state revenues declining and with the local revenues also declining in all areas, we are looking at communities doing contingency planning in terms of their budgets, both for fiscal year 20 and also fiscal year 21. And there's a question regarding if an employee is temporarily furloughed, does the state or PERAC have an ability or interest in considering this furlough period as time served under years of service since the break is due to COVID-19? So that would be a way to lessen the pain of furloughs. Is that something that administratively can happen?
I don't think we know the answer to that. We can look into it. It's not something that I've heard about before, but we'll look into it and respond in our weekly answers.
Thank you very much. That would be important information. Communities obviously are very concerned about the issue of layoffs and furloughs, because these are frontline employees who are delivering critical services, not only to fight the pandemic, but also to rebuild our economy. And we think that, of course, we are united on calling on the federal government to provide direct state aid and direct local aid to make up for revenue losses and provide that stability so those services can maintain. But that's one of the big question marks going forward. I don't know, Lieutenant Governor, do you have any update in terms of discussions? We know the whole congressional delegation here in Massachusetts is very supportive of state stabilization aid, and that you and the governor through the National Governors Association have been working very diligently on this as well.
Yes, I think obviously it's good signal from the feds that they are looking to include in next stimulus funding for municipalities. That is something we've heard from our congressional delegation about. I saw Congressman Neal over the weekend out in Western Mass. We saw Congressman Kennedy this morning in New Bedford, and this is top of mind, which is really important. And I know that you have advocated as well with your communications for these funds. So it's multiple buckets, right? You have the federal funds that possibly could come forward to help in addition to the CARES Act funds. And what relief you know, municipal relief fiscal-wise that could be put into a work stream for a bucket of tools to be able to offset your costs. So you have revenues and costs, and then, you know, streamlining, reforms, all of those other things that we would need to look toward to balance our budgets. We have to work on the state and local level with the monies that come in. We can't just spend like the federal government can. So we have our hands tied in terms of the flexibility we have to produce a balanced budget. So we are all mindful of that. I believe that Sean, you're leading a work team with MMA to sort of create the inventory of ideas around this so that we are ready when these moments come for us to dive more deeply into budgeting.
Yes.
And we'll need I don't know if that's on another call that you do that deeper dive on the fiscal plan for municipalities, but that's certainly an area that we need to continue to develop and will continue to evolve given what kind of support we see from the federal government.
Thank you very much. Yes, and we remember the Municipal Modernization Act and then all of the various proactive steps to provide relief for municipalities is one of the first outreach efforts for the from the administration. Yes, we are in the process of working with DLS and Sean on identifying the broad range of options, and we appreciate the administration's active consideration of all of those. There are a couple of specific questions. One that's left from last week as well. Lieutenant Governor or anyone in the administration, do you have an idea of when guidance may be coming out regarding summer camps or summer school programs and the protocols around those, since the deadlines for applying and setting those up and all the parents are asking and this is something that's top of mind as well?
Yes, that's a very good question. I'm so glad you raised it because we are also receiving calls and communications from you as well as parents trying to plan ahead. So we've asked Secretary Sutters and DPH and EEC and DESE to work together to put guidance together regarding summer camps. And I'm glad that you asked the question because ideally we would like to see these camps activated at the end of the, and I put in quotes, the school year so that there are activities for our youth to return to after school officially ends and have a summertime of things to keep them busy and have a productive and a fun summer. So yes, guidance is coming by mid-May, and that guidance should be able to inform municipalities as well as, you know, nonprofits and others who have these kinds of programming, both public and private programming, to be able to determine if they can incorporate into their camp infrastructure the kinds of safety things that we need, that we would want to see and would be needed in order for parents and youth to be comfortable in those settings. So yes, so I'm hoping that you can hold off on cancellations until you get a look at this guidance to be able to make a more informed decision.
Thank you very much for that, and we look forward to receiving it. Another question, a couple of quick questions. Maybe Sean can give some quick answers. We want to fit everything in. Any update on extension of city budgets or on the question of using dedicated stabilization revolving accounts without restriction in fiscal 21?
So city budgets, we've drafted legislation that I know we've worked with you on, Jeff, and your team. Not sure what the next step is, but that has been drafted. In terms of the use of special revenue funds, which I know in at least Marlborough's case is somewhat different than other cases, but regardless, we have drafted language for the ability to have communities that do dedicate a certain portion, at least 25% of a certain portion of non-property tax revenues for special purpose funds, that those would, special purpose stabilization funds, that those could be used for the general fund budget for fiscal 21. So basically a 1 year cessation of that dedication. And then the 1/12th budget for municipalities, so-called 1/12th, it's really an expenditure authorization, but guidance hopefully end of this week, beginning of next week at the latest. And a reminder that that's for towns. Cities is already a statutory process for the 1/12th. So that unless language changes, that process that's been used in the past will usually be going forward. So the guidance is really for towns. And again, that should be coming out end of the week, this week, or very early next week. And then just two other things I wanted to highlight, because they've been talked about pretty much each week. One thing we talked about was PERAC potentially exploring the option of letting local retirement boards push back the date that the payment needs to be made to the retirement board. And I'm not talking about your full funding date, I'm talking about your fiscal 21 payment to the retirement board. So most communities pay it all up front for financial reasons. That produces a cash flow issue. PERAC issued a memo yesterday. If you haven't seen it, go to their website. It's on there under their memo section, which has given local retirement boards the option to basically push that into, say, January, so that there is some cash flow relief for municipalities. That's something we had talked about before, and that's now final. And then there's been many questions about state grants, and worked with ANF. And the Commonwealth agencies may extend certain end dates on a case-by-case basis. Municipalities should reach out to the relevant agency if you need to seek an extension. There'll be more on that, but you should start now compiling a list internally of grants that might be expiring that you need an extension for, and then get in touch with the relevant agency. But that is something ANF has heard about and is moving to take steps to help municipalities so that those monies don't expire on the date that they're currently supposed to expire. So I don't know if there's any other little odds and ends that have come up, but that's my update.
Thank you very much. You've covered a lot of the questions that are remaining. Hopefully we'll have a chance to get to the others. If we don't, we will seek out with working with you answers to as many as can, or the ones that can be answered, and have those posted on the MMA website and then sent out with a link to everyone in the invitation for next week's briefing. There is a question, I think I'll answer it, but having Elizabeth Denniston on is really good. And Sean, towns pay the full amount for state unemployment benefits. Who pays for the federal $600 a week benefit? I believe that's in the Families First legislation that it's federally funded.
That's my understanding.
Yes. It's always good to hear when a benefit extension is not an unfunded mandate. And we're glad that additional unemployment benefit is available to those in Massachusetts. There's a question about, will the funding for MSBA previously approved projects move forward as approved, or are they subject to change?
So we, as you know, I'm the ANF designee on the authority board, and we had a virtual meeting, I want to say 2 weeks ago, and a couple of us were asking these types of questions. And the short answer is that there should be no impact on projects that are moving forward. We gave the executive director the authority to waive as long as the emergency order is in place, any deadlines that you need to meet, because for obvious reasons, you might not be able to meet them. So that's something, if you're having an issue with, you should check with MSBA staff about. But in terms of the funding, I think it's more downstream than in the short stream, because as you know, they get a penny of the sales tax. So downstream, yeah, there might be some effects, but short term. They have access to the capital market to get money. So a short answer is no.
Okay, that's good to hear. There is a question, Lieutenant Governor, this may be as part of the work of your advisory board. In order to open up the economy after May 18th, daycare centers and providing for childcare for employees who need or would like to go to work, but need to have their children cared for during that time. What is your thinking about that currently?
Yes, that is what I consider one of the prerequisites, like say transportation, childcare, are necessities for certain people to be able to access work. So we have, for instance, Stephanie Pollack as a part of our advisory group to analyze what safe transportation options look like. We've also asked DESE and EEC to continue to advise us on daycare options that could be available. Obviously, emergency daycare remains available throughout this time period. And as we become better informed over the next 2 or 3 weeks, as we do this planning work for reopening, we will continue to engage them on childcare. Now, remember, this is a phased opening. So not everything will be green lighted for May 18th to open. So this will be a phased opening. Plus, there are remote work protocols in place too that will remain. And then there are people that need to actually report in that may need that transportation and childcare infrastructure in place. So we are mindful of that, and we will be able to study that and address that as part of the reopening planning and strategy.
Thank you for that. While you were speaking, there were just a number of comments that came in over the chat line that that just speak to the complexity of a safe restoration of the daycare, of childcare, to protect the families, the children, and the workers, and then make sure that there's enough of a capacity to deal with the phased opening. So very complex questions. And
it's all complex. Oh, there are some ways of being closed. Not that any of this is easy, but it is it's a very hard, complicated process to reopen in a safer way. And without creating a risk that will cause spread or spikes in COVID that could set us back as opposed to helping us in a smooth, safe, and successful fashion move forward. So all of these things need to be balanced, and thank you for understanding the complexity. I don't need to explain that to any of you. You clearly understand it very, very well. Thank you for being patient, but being responsible and being there as a really incredible partner with all of us on the executive side.
Thank you very much. I know that we've come close to the end. The final question or topic, maybe it's just a bookmark or a placeholder, because number of questions have come in regarding pension obligations, pension payments, early retirement options. I'm not sure whether or not the administration is prepared to announce anything that you're looking at the state level, but certainly if there are avenues or opportunities to responsibly take action or provide some flexibility, there are communities that would be interested in that. It's, Sean, I saw that you unmuted yourself.
Yeah, just to note that in the call we had last week with local finance officials, that was certainly a topic. And while there's no real good financially sound way to deal with that, it's obviously something that needs to be talked about if if the local budget situation is as bad as it seems it might be. So yeah, any, you know, those are the types of ideas that we're pulling together. And there's very similar themes that have come through in the discussions, whether it's with folks on this call or other calls. So it's part of terms of just a package of ideas. And then we'll move forward with thinking through the ideas and see how CARES Act money plays out, see if there's another pot of money from the feds for revenue loss at the local level, which would be a game changer, I think, and would put many of these types of ideas to the back burner. So I think it's just, we got to do what we're doing, which is look at these one by one and see how the rest of the picture plays out.
Very good. Thank you. And Lieutenant Governor, we've come over over an hour on the call. We appreciate your being here. Before I wrap up with announcements about the next week's call, do you have any final words?
Just thank you again, and I look forward to our conversations. I believe we'll be on a smaller call tomorrow to talk about the reopening process in more depth. And I appreciate Sean and Elizabeth doing the deeper dives on the fiscal issues that obviously is top of mind for all of you. And I can completely understand that as well. So these deeper dives and these other meetings outside of this weekly meeting are also very productive. And I really just appreciate this time with all of you. And if there are items that we didn't get to, just go through the control tower with Jeff to sort of look at, and then we'll make sure we get back to you. You don't have to wait until next week, obviously, for us to engage in a information sharing on anything that you're troubled with or concerned about.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your leadership and your partnership with municipalities. We will be sending out the notice of the 7th briefing for municipal chief executive officers. That will come out on Friday. There'll be a reminder sent on Monday. And we will meet once again at 1 o'clock in 1 week, next Tuesday, for this briefing. And in the meantime, there will be many, many, many conversations all throughout Massachusetts with the administration. And we appreciate your dedication to hearing from communities in every corner of the state. And we look forward to continuing to do our very best to provide you with the insights and the needs of cities and towns. So this concludes the 6th briefing, and we look forward to seeing everyone next week on Tuesday afternoon with Lieutenant Governor and this talented team of state leaders. Thank you very much, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thanks.